The most important thing is that people have to realize that getting decompression sickness is not a sign of personal weakness. We have to get over that stigma problem where people think they're heroes because they get away with something and their buddy who gets bent doesn't. It's a physiological response.
It's episode 34 of Dive In the Podcast with special guest Neil Pollack. Welcome to Dive In the Podcast, your favorite podcast about all types of diving, scuba, tech, freediving, and more. We cover it all. Every week on Monday, we post new episodes filled with diving news, interesting dive topics, ocean advocacy, and much more. Hey everyone, I'm April.
I'm Amit.
I'm Nick.
I'm Justin.
And we're the hosts of Dive In the Podcast. Tonight we're speaking to Neil Pollack. Neil Pollack is an associate professor in kinesiology at Université Laval in Quebec and research chair at the Centre de Médecine de Plongée du Québec. He was previously research director at Divers Alert Network. His academic training is in zoology, exercise physiology, and environmental physiology. His research interests focus on human health and safety in extreme environments. Welcome to Dive In the Podcast, Neil. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, we do appreciate it. And we got some news to chat about. And then we're going to come back and talk to you about all it is to be Neil Pollack.
I'll study for that test.
Perfect. What do you think about freediving, Neil? How's your breath hold?
Actually, I'm very much a fan of freediving. My personal skill is not fantastic, but it's an incredible challenge.
Yeah. This week, there was a new world record set. Lenka Artnik set a 114-meter monofin record at a competition called Blue Week, hosted by Freediving World. She did a 3-minute and 41-second dive, she said after the dive. The training was really hard to set up this goal and anything but easy to make it happen. I kept going and keeping my motivation high and keeping my goals clear and spice it up with some ups and downs, but nevertheless, successfully accomplished. Nick, how much effort does it take to do 114 meters on a monofin?
Considering I've not been to 114, I'm not even halfway there. But it sounds like very much like all the stories you hear, and especially, you know, talking to people like Sheena McNally from Canada. And nobody sort of has, or very few people, or I don't even know if anybody has a clear trajectory, you know, that have successes right throughout. Like, training is sort of a give and take, and it takes a lot of work to get there. And 114 is you know, I think it's about 16 meters shy of the men's world record. So the women are, in the last few years, have been sort of populating that field of records, and I think there's a lot more to come in that.
That's awesome. I like to see those get closer and closer.
Yeah, and as they get deeper, the increments get smaller, and the records get far and fewer in between. It's kind of interesting to see where the men's world records are going. Apparently, William Trubridge has set a world record announcement for December. It was supposed to be November, but it's been postponed to December, so see what happens there.
Yeah, interesting. Well, we'll check it out and let everybody know when we find out. Let's circle back around to Neil. So, Neil, I hear you're from landlocked Edmonton, Alberta, here in Canada. But what's your first recollection of the ocean and diving?
Well, I was fortunate enough as a kid that we would spend a week on the coast every summer. And so I have a lot of memories of that. I was also a competitive swimmer from about age 8 or 9. And so the connection between swimming and the ocean and let's get into diving was pretty early in my life.
At what point did you end up getting into diving itself?
I was on the coast one summer, and my mother was very smart. She always let me make my decision. She would let me gather the information. She thought I usually made pretty good decisions. So she took me to a dive shop, and fortunately, the person I spoke to was one who believed that you should be a little older to start diving, because I now definitely agree with that. So I started when I was 17, and haven't quit.
And so how old were you when you'd made that first kind of journey into the dive shop where you started asking these questions to gather information?
I think I was about 12 when we went into that dive shop, but it really was at 9. I grew up reading some adventure stories, so I wasn't so much a fan of the Jacques Cousteau time or shows, but there were a series of pulp books that talked about underwater adventures, often with hard hat divers. And those really appealed to me. So from a very early age, I was hooked on the underwater world.
And that's obviously stuck with you throughout your life. Is it still those kinds of dives that really interest you now, or is other things interesting you?
One of the things that I've been really fortunate with is to be exposed to a variety of environments and technologies. And what I really like is the variety. I love being able to go from tropical to polar water and from wetsuit to dry suit, from open circuit to closed circuit. It is interesting the different ways you can put diving to life.
You don't pigeonhole yourself into a single box, I guess.
I try not to. I mean, I describe my research interest as health and safety of humans in extreme environments. And that's about as broad as I can make it.
That gives you a lot of room, I guess, to kind of study wherever you would like to.
It does.
Yeah. I see why there would be an appeal for that, right? Because if you become very specialized in a specific thing, I guess you wouldn't have that opportunity to kind of step outside of your speciality.
It is true. And I think I've always appreciated being in a skilled area, but a generalist. So you can go different ways. And it does make life much more interesting and creates a lot more opportunities. Mm. When I first looked at going to graduate school, I went to UCLA to talk to them about a program. And I was disappointed to learn that a lot of their faculty were so specialized. The example they gave, one faculty member's entire research was on one muscle of mastication, of chewing. So one muscle in the human body that was involved with chewing. And I thought, okay, that is not for me.
Yeah, I can't see myself. I'd probably be with you in terms of turning high tail and heading out of there for that one. But.
So, Neil, you went to university to study zoology originally. How did you end up sort of on the leading edge of hyperbaric research? What's that journey like?
Zoology for me was a simple choice. I wanted a liberal science education, and I thought about geology, but I decided I liked living things a little bit more than non-living. So zoology was a good choice, but when I was coming out of it, I was not interested in spending the years as a research technician that you had to do to get ahead. So interestingly, I spent easily as many years getting ahead in the diving industry. But that worked because it allowed me to combine the science, the natural history, and my love for teaching. And so it was just a very comfortable fit. So once I became established, I was offered a position as the university diving officer at the University of British Columbia. And that was just great fun. You're responsible for the health and safety of scientific divers in a variety of different applications. And it just kept going from there. I did my PhD because I was invited to Florida to coordinate the data collection on a research program out of Duke. And after that PhD, we worked hard to get me up to Duke. So for me, my entire career has been a function of saying yes to opportunities and then trying to work as hard as you can to make sure that you get the next invitation.
Well, that's pretty cool. So it wasn't really one of these things where you sort of had it pre-planned that this is the direction that I want to go and I'm going to end up going down to, you know, to Florida or go to Duke. Those things were just natural progressions?
Yeah. Well, I'm not even sure I'd say natural progressions. I think of it as a web approach to life. You can go in a straight line or you can get to the same endpoint through any number of different pathways. And I have never had a programmed path. Coming out of zoology, there aren't any, it's not a professional degree. So you don't have a job prospect waiting for you. And so my entire life, I've tended to shy away from structure that other people put on me. And I've tried to find the way to make my path my own in the world.
How did it come up that you were going to be the research director for Divers Alert Network?
Well, okay. Now, this is another one of those things that evolves. I was at Duke working in the Hyperbaric Center, and Dan formed out of Duke. So at one point, Dan was a telephone on a desk in the Hyperbaric Center. But this now is 20 years later. And so, well, a little shy of 20 years later, there was a whole separate building and Dan was a different entity. I, when I went to Duke, started supporting some of the Dan activity, writing a little bit for them and going to some of the functions. And over time, I got more and more involved. The real turning point was when we were running a little bit short on research money, and Dan agreed to pick up part of my salary until we had more research funds. And at that point, I felt very obligated because I appreciated that support. So I started doing even more with them. And then I ended up becoming research director and stayed in that position until I was recruited back to Canada.
That's overall pretty encouraging to see. I guess it was one of these ones where obviously you're supporting them, they're supporting you, and you would have had a unique opportunity, I think, to invest in, I guess, the idea of safety for divers. While you were there at Dan, what would you say would have been the most significant project that you were involved with?
I'm going to answer that question with two answers, because my time was split between Duke and Dan. And so at Dan, I'd say the single biggest project we worked on was flying after diving. And that was started by the fellow who really brought me to Duke, Dick Van. And he was the vice president of research at Dan for a long time until he retired. And he started flying after diving, but as he moved more to the senior role, I ended up taking over the coordination of that program. And we wrapped it up after 20 years of research. So that ended up being a pretty big effort. On the Duke side, we had a lot of funding from NASA. And so the biggest project commitment or contribution we had there was developing pre-breathe protocols for astronauts, because astronauts are at risk of decompression sickness when they go from space station pressure to the low pressure of the suit that they're going to do the spacewalk in. And historically, they use an oxygen pre-breathe to get rid of the nitrogen, so they reduce the risk of decompression sickness. The problem is that it took 4 hours of passive breathing, and it was using up very limited supplies of high-pressure oxygen. And it made the day, working day, too long for the astronauts as well. So we were tasked with coming up with a faster solution. So we combined exercise in the oxygen pre-breathe to get them out of the spacecraft faster. And we did end up coming up with developing two protocols that worked. And those are both used still in the space program. And when I say we, I do want to be careful here. There are a lot of people who were involved at Duke, and we also worked with a multi-center group, including DCIEM in Canada. And so this was definitely not a lone group of people who did this. This was a big, big effort.
Wow, that's incredible. And, you know, I mean, I do have another question I wanted to ask you as well. But coming out of that, I guess one of the things, like, is there a way for you to explain, simply put, like, what, you know, what that means? Like, how did you combine those, that exercise physiology piece with the oxygen pre-breathe to accelerate that process?
Absolutely. And I will give you a pretty straightforward explanation, but I want you to realize that it's not simple, because we had a bunch of very bright people trying to develop the perfect protocol. We tested 11 of them, and each one we thought had a really good chance of working. 9 of them failed, many spectacularly. And so when you're doing these combinations, the concept is simple. But boy, the execution is exquisite in the complications it throws at you. Having said that, the simple explanation is, instead of breathing oxygen at rest, which gives you gas exchange, but at a modest level, we have people exercising to increase their cardiac output, increase their breathing rate, and it exchanges the gases faster. And so we flush inert gas out of the body quicker than if they were at rest. The problem is, if you have too much exercise, you can actually promote the formation of bubbles or nuclei that will ultimately form bubbles. And so there's a very fine line. And the best combination that we ended up finding, if we did a short phase of high intensity exercise during oxygen breathing, it would clear out a lot of gas. And if we then went to a low level of exercise, it would help them recover while still getting rid of a little bit more gas. And then if we had a resting phase before they did the decompression, that seemed to give us the sweet spot. And we ended up not having any cases of decompression sickness in our trials on that protocol.
Wow, that's really cool. So the logical question for me from that happens to be, is there a translation to scuba diving?
Absolutely. there is a translation to scuba, and not so much, of course, in the getting rid of gas, but in terms of the risk. And let me describe this to you. This will hopefully work on a podcast. If we had our subjects laying in a semi-recumbent, semi-reclined position for the entire day, for an 11-hour day, they did not walk. And that's because in space, you don't have loading on your lower body. So we were taking away the loading on the lower body. If we did that with the second protocol we developed, we had no decompression sickness. If, however, we had just 7 4-minute bouts in the 11-hour day where they got off the cot and they walked in place at a slow rate, just step, 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 step for 4 minutes, we jumped to 20% decompression sickness. And so how this translates into diving, when you think you're in pretty good shape, you just cleared your decompression, you're on the surface, you're ready to swim in, you swim in and work hard to climb the ladder, or even worse, climb up the beach and then hump your gear up to your vehicle, you are increasing your risk of problems dramatically. Mm-hmm. And so the impact of exercise, it's a dual-edged sword. It can help you if the intensity and the timing is right, or it can hurt you if it's wrong.
Wow, that's really translatable. There's no question about it. When I think about that, we have a lot of guys, one of the only, really deep accessible sites to us to practice our deco dives. You basically climb down and, of course, back up on the exit, a bit of a cliff, and then you go out and you do your deco dive and you come back out. And most people, because you don't want to do the rest or multiple trips up and down the hill, will try to huck all their gear out on the very first stop, right? So they've finished their deco and then immediately they're hiking up a hill with 100 pounds of gear. So it sounds to me like that's a pretty bad idea.
It's a very bad idea. And the worst thing about it is that it won't get you every time. And so you get away with it once and you think, I'm bulletproof, this is fine. But we have the potential for subclinical symptoms or subclinical, pardon me, impact. And over time, those can bite you. So the smartest way to look at it is to remember that your dive computer doesn't know anything about the physical activity you're doing during the dive or after the dive. So you have to build in the margins. And the best way to start building in the margins, first, extend your shallow stops, either decompression or safety, whatever they may be. Extend those as long as you can. Then when you get to the surface, if you're on a rebreather, keep breathing on that mouthpiece so you have high PO2 gas. If you're on open circuit scuba, you won't get that much help, but you rest at the surface a little bit before you start the walk. The longer you delay, the better off you'll be. And it's hard to convince people of that, especially if they've not had a problem in the past. But one of the things that we really have to make sure divers understand is that our health and fitness tends to be on a trajectory downward as we age. No matter what, you will not get consistently more fit and more healthy as you get older. And so even if you've managed something earlier in your life, you should not set that as your safe standard.
Now, that's actually really interesting and makes obviously perfect sense when you think about that. I don't know if there's any of us that are really improving in health. I know I certainly am not probably doing a great job of staying as fit as I was when I was younger. So yeah, and I don't want to dominate too much of the conversation here, but I did have one other question related to this. And it was really just, is there a window that you would say, like, if you were looking at this and you had to give a rest period? Because I think of this as being a practical applicability, not just for myself, but for any other diver that's doing the same type of thing. Like, is there a window where you can say safely, you know, following 10, 15 minutes, it might be better, then you can start doing this and, of course, reduce your loads that you're taking up and down the strenuous paths? Or is it just kind of, you just have to be cautious all the way around because there's no definitive answer?
Well, the depressing answer is no, there's no simple rule. But let me explain that. The way you can improve your decompression safety dramatically is not necessarily by trying to put in a single buffer, but to be conscious of it through the entire dive. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you want to do a multi-level dive, you want to go deep, fine, go deep, but don't stay there. Start doing your multi-level run earlier. Mm-hmm. Buffer your gradient factors so you're running a lower gradient factor high, so you have a bigger reserve between your limit and that theoretical M value limit of beyond this bad things happen. Mm-hmm. Don't exercise at the bottom. Exercise lightly during the ascent and the decompression stop. Try to exercise enough to stay warm, but not so much that you are getting high joint forces that could promote bubble formation. Mm-hmm. And if you think about things like that and many others, I put together a figure of this once, and there are about two dozen factors, that can directly contribute to decompression safety. And if you make minor changes on a number of those parameters, at the end of the day, you are more likely to be able to get away with a lot. And the nice thing about this safety-oriented attitude is instead of seeing it as how far can I push this and get away with it, you start thinking, how can I add a little bit more buffer that doesn't cost me anything? And then at the end of the day, you have very little to worry about. So now we go back to your original question. If somebody was diving by adding conservative bits throughout the dive, they might be able to be safe walking straight up after they surface. For someone who, for whatever reason, ended up pushing it a little bit harder on that dive, maybe they should be waiting. And I will say that there's no magic in a 3-minute safety stop. If three minutes is good, 5 minutes is better, and 10 minutes is even better than that. It's the same with waiting before you climb the hill. If you're not in a hurry to do it, wouldn't it be nice if you had a picnic basket at the bottom that you could open up and have some lunch before you climb that hill? Whatever it takes to slow you down.
That would be fantastic. I think we should arrange for that at the end of every dive. I wanted to switch gears a little bit and just chat because I know you're currently the research chair in hyperbaric and diving medicine at Université Laval in Quebec. And this is touted to be one of the first of its kind in North America. Can you tell us why it's the first of its kind and what it meant to you really as a Canadian to get a chance to come home and lead such an important field of research?
It was the first of its kind because diving, as you might imagine, on the face of it, doesn't sound like a really great area for a university to invest in a research program. Because they think diving, isn't that just going out in the sun and having fun and chasing fish? So it's not necessarily a standard academic field. All through my training, I actually taught human anatomy and physiology, thinking that that's what would get me a job, and diving would then be something I could study because I had the other thing to get me the job. But diving and hyperbaric medicine has some important applications, and University Laval was bold enough to say, we want to invest in this area. We have a brand new chamber. They put in a state-of-the-art chamber in Lévis, Quebec. And they decided we're going to support this with research initiatives. And so there were a lot of people who put in a lot of hard effort to convince the university that this was worthwhile. And because I was Canadian and known to some of these folks, they invited me to come up and take it on. And it was an exciting opportunity because I had always expected to come back to Canada. When I left Vancouver, I expected to be gone 3 to 5 years, not 26. Wow. But time passes when people offer you interesting things to do. But coming back to Laval was a great opportunity, in fact. I do have to correct one thing. The research chair is what I was offered, invited back for, but we are just now finishing the fundraising to fully fund that chair. So we're actually within about less than 10% of our target. And so the chair isn't formalized until we have that solid funding in place, but it is going to be formalized imminently.
Wow. That's pretty exciting.
So if we have anybody with deep pockets who wants to support diving research in Canada, I know where you can put your money.
Perfect.
So I'm curious, since this is sort of, like you said, it's not something a university traditionally sort of invests in. Is there context, at least within Canada, for hyperbaric research or in the field of diving research that would sort of have led to that?
Yes, there is. The history that Canada has is actually quite strong, and probably the best to focus on is the work of DCIEM in Downsview, basically a suburb of Toronto. And DCIEM is the Defense and Civil Institute of Environmental Medicine. And in the 60s, that unit was very active in studying diving physiology for military operations primarily. And one of the first of two major contributions was to develop techniques in ultrasonic monitoring that are still the standard today in studying decompression stress. We all want a tricorder. For any of your people out there who are Star Trek fans, come on, give me a tricorder. We can get this done. But until we have the tricorder, we're limited to things like ultrasound to track bubbles. And DCIM put together the most impressive way to analyze bubble signals. That's number one. The second thing that came out of their research analyzing bubble signals were the DCIM dive tables. So that's a Canadian dive table that is more conservative than, say, the US Navy table, but it's based on producing only low bubble scores in the subjects. And so it is arguably, it is the best tested. It was initially based on 1,600 person exposures. No other dive table had that kind of record. And it's based on ensuring low bubble grades, which dramatically reduce the risk. And those are major contributions of Canada. And to add one last thing onto that, I'm pleased to say that Shearwater Research, which produces dive computers, they have taken on the act of putting the DCIM tables in a dive computer, because until now they were always a paper table. But Shearwater is maintaining that legacy for Canada, basically, by putting the tables in a computer. And I'm really excited about this, because a lot of the margins that I know I've recommended through my studies using ultrasound to look at bubbles in technical divers, the safety margins I propose, my guess is they're going to end up being pretty much in line with the DCIM limits. And that's pretty impressive that was achieved in Canada.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Following that up then, is there any research you're currently leading or that you hope to contribute in the future in the field of hyperbaric and dive medicine?
Well, we have a lot of projects that are underway now, and that's really what I'm trying to do, is try to get people interested and encourage different avenues of research. So once more, what would define my activity is the variety. The first funding we got was from a provincial group, Réseau Québec Maritime, and in that project, we were looking at the health and safety of professional divers in Canada. And pardon me, in Quebec. So we were looking at the knowledge level, identifying areas of deficiency and maybe areas where practice was suboptimal, and giving them some tools to manage those gaps, to address the problems. That's one. Another project that I have a doctoral student finishing right now is reviewing 15 years of a diving medicine call center activity that's been run in Quebec since 2004. And so we've got 3,200 contacts that we're able to look at and see what kind of problems occur in the diving community. We've got a lot of funding that's come from the Canadian Space Agency. One of the advantages of doing the work at Duke with some Canadian collaborators is that when I came here, I was known. And so we were fortunate in getting some CSA funding to continue work in physiological monitoring. The next step in decompression safety for astronauts and for divers is to have real-time physiological monitoring that allows your decompression profile to be changed on the fly. And we're not anywhere close to that yet, but that is where we're going. And I'm really happy when we get funding from Canadian Space Agency or the Department of National Defense to help pay for the research.
That's interesting. That'll be the next generation of smartwatch dive computer that's monitoring your vitals and incorporating that into their algorithm.
Indeed.
Yeah, that's neat.
And now, just before you go on, because I have to give a fair share to everything, those are all the diving side. We also work on looking at the hyperbaric medicine side. And a simple example, we're finishing off a project now looking at the safety of hyperbaric exposure for patients who have compromised heart activity. If they have low ventricular ejection fraction, their heart's not kicking out too much blood. As I expect most divers will understand, when you're in a hyperbaric environment, especially breathing oxygen, the amount of oxygen that is delivered to your tissues is huge. And so it's actually easier on the heart. But one of the questions is, what happens when you pull people out of that exposure? Is that suddenly putting a huge strain on a weak heart? And so we've got a study looking at that. And we have another one looking at the safety of hyperbaric oxygen therapy for people being treated for post-radiation wounds. So we really do try to cover the range. If it has to do with altered pressure environments, we're there.
It's exciting. There's so much amazing stuff going on in Canada. We're going to take a quick commercial break and we'll be right back. More with Neil Pollock. Hi, everyone. I just wanted to take a second to thank our sponsor, Torpedo Rays Scuba. Torpedo Rays is a local dive shop in Nova Scotia. If you're not in Nova Scotia, that's okay. They've got a wonderful website, torpedorays.com, TORPEDORAYS.com. All of the scuba gear you could ever need is there. If you can't find it, give Jason a call, 902-481-0444, and he'll be happy to help you out. And in these challenging times, it's always great to shop local. Don't go to a huge, big box. Help support your local dive shop. Buy something you've had your eye on. Excellent time to make a good deal. Buy a gift certificate to use later. Whatever the case may be, Torpedo Rays and torpedorays.com will be there for you. Once again, their number is 902-481-0444 or torpedorays.com.
So welcome back, and we are speaking with Neil Pollock. Early on in the pandemic, there were some alarming reports on the effects of COVID-19 on divers. Where do we stand 8 months into this pandemic with that research, Neil?
Well, that's a very good question. And I hate to be giving all the depressing answers, but the reality is the picture is not getting as clear as it is blurry. COVID-19 ends up being able to affect a variety of organ systems to a variety of levels of intensity. And so there are some people who do very well when they're exposed, some people who do very badly. And it isn't as simple as if you're older than 55 or 60, you have to worry. There are a lot of people who are young and healthy who are seriously impacted, and a lot of people throughout the age range who can get by with very little recognizable response. So the biggest thing that defines the COVID-19 response is idiosyncrasy. You first off want to try to avoid it as best you can. And if you do get it, the best advice that exists right now, if you're asymptomatic but you've tested positive, you should probably be staying out of the water for at least a month. If you have mild symptoms, you probably should be looking at a 2 to 3 month period out of the water to make sure you're fully resolved. And most importantly, every case of people testing positive has to be individually evaluated, because you might have no long-term effects, but there is some evidence of people who have what could be potentially permanent changes to the pulmonary and cardiovascular systems. And so This is not a mild disease. You know, it can be for some people, but you could get the bad luck of having a very negative response. And divers have to understand that they need to be checked out by somebody who's familiar with diving medicine before they go back into the water.
Wow. Sounds like it's definitely one of these ones where you can't take it for granted and just say, I feel better today and I'm gonna head back out for a dive. Neil, you were part of the Diver Medical Screen Committee, the DMSC. You were also in that charge with revising one of the most important documents in recreational technical diving, which was the Diver Medical Declaration Form and the Notes for Physician, a process that took about 3 years. And then you guys published, I think this year, June of 2020. The previous document was quite dated, at being produced in 1989. Now, when I went back, you were quoted in X-Ray magazine as saying, and I quote, "There were a number of elements that sorely needed revision and many more that benefited from the effort. And the shift to a living form with more frequent updating is particularly important to ensure that the documentation reflects current perspectives," end quote. I know there's a lot of work that goes into that, but can you summarize the key changes that were made in that document and why it was so important for it to be a living document for us everyday divers?
Well, it is important. I'll answer the second part first. It is important because the majority of diving instruction almost in the world now is using this form. And so it is really seeing a lot of exposure. the current form is now translated, I think, in 22 languages or something already. It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But it is important because of the reach. And it's important because even though in 1989 we understood some of the concerns that divers would face, we now have a little bit better sensitivity as to how to get information out of them. So a lot of the material in the form is similar. How we get information from the diver is different, and it's to try to minimize the ability or minimize missing problems. Mm-hmm. And so it's still a two-part questionnaire. It's actually very strongly now a two-part questionnaire. You have 10 questions you answer, and they're worded in such a way that they're broad enough that we hope people will respond if they have anything like those issues. And then you go to part B, where it has a little bit more detail, where you can either confirm or confirm that you don't have those kinds of problems. So there's a lot more psychology that went into trying to make the information robust, so we didn't have as many misses. Mm-hmm. In terms of changes, one of the things that I really was most frustrated with for years was the exercise capacity that was written in the medical documentation. There's a fellow who is a leading cardiologist and diving physician, Fred Beauvais, and he was a lifelong military person and runner, dedicated to fitness. And he looked at some of the old Navy data, and those data showed that people had to be able to, or the highest work rate that they could see in a Navy diver in full gear was what's called 13 METs, 13 metabolic equivalents. That is, they were able to exercise at 13 times their resting intensity. And the Navy has a lot of people who want to become divers, so they could take the top 1 or 2%. So they said, we won't take anybody who has a fitness capacity less than 13 METs. Well, Fred thought this was a good idea, so he pushed in several papers that a 13-met capacity should be the qualification for a diver. Well, yes, it's true. In a perfect world, that would be the case, but that's not really the question. The question is, how fit does a diver need to be to dive safely? It's not about where we'd like divers. It's where should they be? Because here's where you have to think about it from a U.S. point of view. In the medical form, on the original, if you read the documentation, for the assigning physician, it said, I confirm that a fitness level less than 13 METs could reflect a serious risk to diving safety. And I'm paraphrasing, that those aren't the exact words. But that actually opens those people up to lawsuits, because it says on the form that, yeah, we think 13 METs is a good goal. And let me tell you, I did a review of published aerobic fitness data on diving, and the average fitness level that we got to was 12 METs. And that means that 50% of the people are under that point. If we actually look at that 13 MET cutoff, we were probably excluding 75% of the diving population. And if we were killing 1,000 divers a year, maybe we would have justification for saying, oh yeah, it's 13 METs or you're out. But we're not seeing that many problems, so we had to be more rational. And what we did in the current form is we're much more rational on talking about fitness. It's still important. We still promote it. But we're not saying that if you don't have 13 METs, you shouldn't be in the water. Mm-hmm. So again, it's a challenging thing. We want people to be fit, but I am not a fan of saying things that are just not realistic. Other changes to the form, the comment box is gone. So there used to be a comment box that physicians could add extra information. But sometimes, particularly if the physician was not really knowledgeable about diving medicine, information could be entered into that box that could actually cause that form to be rejected when the person went diving. Mm. And so that was eliminated. And one of the things that comes up as a frequent question, why was the question asking about previous decompression sickness removed? Well, I have a take on that. If you get decompression sickness once, you can go one of two ways. If you ignore it and you say, it wasn't my fault, it was the phase of the moon, it was the color of my buddy's dry suit, it was anything other than their responsibility, they aren't likely to get bent again. So yes, knowing that they were bent once, that's good information. However, if you have someone who gets bent once and they discover religion, the religion being, how do I make sure I can keep diving but do it safely to never repeat this, they will probably never have another problem in their life. And so knowing a history of decompression sickness is actually not useful in the decision-making.
That last mention there really speaks to human behaviors, right? And the decisions we make as divers. I find that super fascinating because I worked with some fishermen in the Caribbean that scuba dive to harvest, and they get bent all the time and they keep making the same decisions. So I found that sort of that explanation from you pretty fascinating.
I'll take it one step further. These people who are getting bent repeatedly, they may think they're getting away with it, but we know from some of the records we saw from North Sea commercial divers in the 60s and 70s, if people have a history of repeated experiences with decompression sickness and they're diving aggressively, they are at greater risk of developing debilitating bone problems, dysbaric osteonecrosis. If it occurs in the mid-shaft of the bone, you may not do too badly, but if it occurs close to a joint, it can ultimately lead to complete joint collapse, and that's typically of the shoulder or the hip joint.
Wow, that sounds a pretty painful consequence long term.
It is, and that's why for me, we have to get divers. And one of the most important things we can do is to change the mindset of divers so they don't think in terms of I got away with it, but they think in terms of how do I make sure that I can dive for the next 80 years and still be safe and healthy.
Where do we start with making divers behave better, I guess, is a question.
Communication. I mean, you're now, this is what I do for a living, is to try to, you try to gather the data and you try to report at different levels. We publish papers so physicians can see them, so researchers can see them, and then you do cut downs so the professional leaders can see that material, and then real lay articles so every diver on the street can hopefully pick something up. You just try to hit people across all levels and hope that individual or some culture changes in the right direction or is reinforced in the right direction. Not all that needs to be changed. Some good practices just need to be reinforced.
So speaking of that, you know, here in Canada, we're kind of synonymous with cold water diving. Is there an elevated risk of DCS with cold water diving?
As usual, the answer is yes and no. It depends on what you do. So first off, it seems with your questions, I like answering the second one first.
That's okay.
Because it's cold water, if cold water keeps you from going down as deep and staying as long, it actually might decrease your decompression stress. If you go through your gas supply quicker, you might not get in trouble. So that's a plus. If, on the other hand, you decide that you're going to buy into the latest and greatest and you're going to go for active heating garments so you can extend your bottom time, you could be potentially creating a problem for yourself because they work. But the way they work is not always in your favor. If you actively heat on the way down, you're increasing blood flow, which is increasing the delivery of inert gas to all of your peripheral tissues. And so if you're using active heating when you're at the bottom, you are soaking up inert gas like there's no tomorrow. And if, worst case scenario, that heated garment was to fail, batteries were to fail, or it was to short out on the way up, you would come up cool. And that means you'd be vasoconstricted. You wouldn't be delivering blood to those tissues, so you wouldn't be eliminating the inert gas. And so in that situation where you go down warm and come up cool, you have the worst case scenario where you could get bent badly. And let me give you some numbers. There was a brilliant piece of work that was done by the U.S. Navy in Panama City, Florida. And they manipulated temperature of the dive. They had it split between the bottom phase and the ascent and decompression phase. And to give you the nutshell version, if people went down warm and came up cool, so they went down and had lots of uptake, came up and had poor elimination, with a 30-minute bottom time, they bent, oh goodness, I don't have the numbers in front of me, on the order of 20%, and I won't stand by that 20%, but a substantial percentage was bent. If the divers went down cool and then had mild warming on the way up, they were able to increase the bottom time to 70 minutes, and they only bent 1.3% of their subjects. So just changing thermal status alone had a huge impact on decompression safety. And that's an important thing to realize before you buy the active heating garments, because one of the things that I think is a huge disservice to the community is that none of the manufacturers are really open about discussing the fact that use of their products may alter decompression risk.
From what I've seen, they're generally pretty much non-existent and just, here's your heated garment, go have fun.
Mm-hmm. What advice do you have for a recreational diver that has had DCS and might be traumatized by the experience and that's looking to return on the assumption that they're medically cleared?
Well, the most important thing is that people have to realize that getting decompression sickness is not a sign of personal weakness. We have to get over that stigma problem where people think they're heroes because they get away with something and their buddy who gets bent doesn't. It's a physiological response. And I've been bent twice in research studies. The first time I was bent, the fellow who brought me to Duke, Dick Van, he gave me a set of fuzzy dice, the kind that you hang on your rearview mirror in the 70s. And he yes. said, this is to remind you that there's always an element of chance in decompression sickness. And it's absolutely true. So the first thing you want to do is make people realize you got bent, you have a warning, and so now you pay attention to it, get smarter, and you can very possibly, as you say, if you're clear to dive again, you can very possibly dive completely safely for the rest of your career, if you're smart. And so for me, it's about education. You want to make people realize it's not about weakness, it's about managing risk.
Is there an automatic assumption that you're predisposed to a subsequent hit because you've had it once?
It depends. We bend people at Duke. We did studies that included the endpoint of decompression sickness. And we could do that ethically because we had a really good record for unbending divers with no recognizable increase in future risk. I dived operationally throughout my time there, and I was bent in research studies, but I didn't ever see it impact me in operational diving. And so that's if you get quick treatment. Now, that's when we're in a controlled research environment. When somebody gets symptoms, normally in the NASA trials, within 5 minutes, we have to have the chamber on the way to treatment. In normal studies, other studies, flying after diving, we would often have people being treated within 20 minutes. But that was fast enough that there seemed to be no future risk change. However, if we look at the person who's bent when they're out doing their own dive offshore, the average time to the start of treatment, recompression treatment, is 24 hours. That may be associated with a higher risk of complications or alteration in future risk. We just don't know because, again, this is ethically an impossible area to study. But it is a concern. And so that's why, again, my approach is to try to give people the tools they need to avoid it in the first place. And some people have said that I'm too conservative. I actually don't believe I'm too conservative. I'm willing to allow any bottom profile. For me, you do that bottom profile you want, but then you add all the decompression that you need to make sure that you hit the surface in a conservative state. And I don't view that as too conservative. For me, it's much more fun to be in the water anyway, and it's a lot of fun to come out of the water safely.
That speaks back to what we were talking about earlier, right? About sort of coming out of the water and climbing up a hill.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think I'd listened to a talk that you'd given at one point where you, I think you drew a reference to that, is that, you know, if you're there and you have the opportunity to stay underwater and you have the gas to be there, why wouldn't you use it and just enjoy the time that you have, right?
That is a great, great point. I probably have one of my highest levels of frustration when I see people who think they're heroic or they're better divers because they got out of the water 5 minutes before their buddy. That is a truly silly position. A, they just changed the algorithm. They didn't do anything. And yeah, yeah. B, they got to the surface faster. That's all it means. It doesn't mean they're better or smarter or more skilled. It often means they're not thinking as well. But people are motivated by funny things. And again, we have to try to turn the mindset away from we're heroes to be here and instead turn it to this is a great world, but I have to be aware of it. How can I do it safely for an entire career?
Neil, as dive buddies, how can we support our buddies as they return to diving following medical clearance after a DCS?
Well, I think there are a couple of steps. Number one, try to find out what happened and what can be done to avoid similar problems in the future. If you have one of those buddies who's a cowboy who says, it wasn't me, it was the phase of the moon, I'm doing everything right, what you should do is find a new buddy.
Yeah.
It's my thought.
Or turn them into the second type of buddy where they say, okay, I'm going to pay more attention. I'm going to try to do things as reasonably as I can. I'm going to try to add some conservatism and different elements. Then you want to support them by saying, hey, if you want to stay in the water longer on that safety stop or decompression stop, I'm there with you. I'll hang out. And that is probably the best support you can give someone is to say, you want to be conservative? Let's be conservative together and make it enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's fantastic. And so, Neil, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to speak with us. We definitely are looking forward to having you back. I'm hoping that you'd be willing to come back and chat with us a bit more about hyperbaric research. That's really quite important, obviously, to the sport that we love here. I know from my very first contact with you, where you were wholeheartedly willing to jump on the show to share this knowledge, up till now in terms of organizing it to be on the show, it's been an absolute pleasure to work with you. I wanted to end by asking sort of the last question that we ask a lot of our guests, which is, what keeps you diving?
It is a wonderful, wonderful part of the world. And I've had the real honor of being able to do it for more than 40 years. I love going back even to the same places and just seeing how the patterns of life change over time. For me, it's the life. I'm not that interested in caves because I find I get bored without the life. But to go into that environment and to feel welcomed and to explore it and see it and feel the rhythms, I just don't get tired of that.
That's fantastic.
It's one of those things that's a reoccurring, we hear that from all of our guests, the same kind of sentiments stated in 50 different ways, but it all comes down to the same thing. It's just great to be there. Thanks, Neil. We're going to talk about BCDs for a minute. My segment this week on gearing up, we've had some listeners asking about kind of more basic things. So one of the things we want to take a look at today is just BCDs and the differences. As a dive shop manager, the questions I get asked, a lot of people think, oh, you know, everyone knows what the difference between a jacket and a back inflation BCD is. So we're going to take a step back. We've been having a pretty advanced and deep conversation with Neil here tonight, but this is going to be a little bit more simplistic. BCDs come in a few different flavors. The jacket inflation is probably the most common thing we have around. The jacket inflates around you, kind of gives you a bit of a hug. It's warm and fuzzy. A lot of us are trained how to scuba dive in those, and they're often the rental BCDs that you'll find in various places. Back inflation BCDs arguably trim out better and more easily in the water because the air inflates behind you and kind of pontoons almost on either side of the tank, and that kind of allows you to generally hang there and better trim in the water. Both of those sometimes have the option these days of an alternate inflator system that some companies call like Aqualung, the I3, and some of the others where they have a little lever instead of a over-the-shoulder inflator. That's totally just your choice. Pick which one you like. There's the I3 from Aqualung is a simple cable driven thing, and it opens up all the dump valves on all the different parts of the jacket, so you can trim or you can dump air more easily without having to kind of futz with your position. Now, a lot of people, including a lot of the divers on our podcast, tend to kind of take it a step further and go to a backplate and wing system. This gives you the ultimate flexibility. It's kind of found more in the tech communities, but it's definitely absorbed by lots and lots of recreational divers. You match your backplate choice to your harness choice to your wing choice, and you can make changes from dive to dive, or you can make changes from year to year, and you can kind of keep and change things out. So it might be a little bit more expensive up front, but it's probably the most flexible system that's going to last you years and years and years. There's also specialized equipment like emit side mount harnesses. To the average diver, the first time you see something like an XD side mount harness with this little tiny buoyancy compensator that wraps around you with a bungee cord and a double ended bolt snap, they kind of, you know, shake their head, but everything has its place and they're, you know, they do their job really well. So most important thing about a BCD is just taking your time, figuring out, see what you like, because I'm always a fan of going with what makes you comfortable and what makes you, gives you that warm and fuzzy feeling. I don't think you have to rely on, you know, well, Joe told me I've got to buy a Eagle Ranger because that's what he's had for 20 years. So take a look, try some stuff on and go from there. Neil, do you have a preferred open circuit kind of setup? I imagine you're a back plate and wing kind of guy.
I definitely like back inflation. But I think there's also an element to this discussion that's important, and that is, what inflation system should you use if you have a BCD and a dry suit?
Do you have a preference there?
I do. You know, there are a lot of people who say, oh, you should use the BCD and take the strain off the dry suit. My belief is, if you have a dry suit that is strained by inflation, get a better dry suit.
For me, with you.
It comes down to simplicity. If you use your dry suit as your primary buoyancy, you're only controlling one system. So when things are going wrong, you're only eliminating gas from one system. If you have to dump from two systems, because you always have to put some air in the dry suit to avoid being squeezed on the way down.
Right.
So
right.
To me, it should be dry suit all the time, and the BC is a backup only if you need it. And there's one last benefit of that, and that is it helps remind you to keep your weight at the minimal level. Because if you're adding too much air to that dry suit, you will hopefully realize that you probably have too much lead on. By dumping it, you'll add less air to begin with and less to dump. And if you're only putting it in and out of one system, it's much safer.
I'm happy to hear that you reflect my opinions, and took about 30 or 40 minutes of my dry suit course down to three sentences. So perfect.
I'm also relieved. I'm glad that I use my dry suit as my buoyancy control, and I'm on the same page as Neil. Makes me feel good.
Mitt, we'll chat about side mount tonight.
Yeah, I can do. I was just going to do actually just a really quick kind of cover on this, primarily because I've been asked actually since the last side mount segment, this question's come up about three or four times with different folks that I've been talking to. And it's really something as simple as, like, you know, what are the benefits versus some of the drawbacks of side mount? I think, like, you know, I think in all fairness, I think I've said that I would try to be objective when I talk about side mount. It's a very difficult thing for me to do. But, you know, I think I'll cover off, because it's harder for me and I want to make sure I'm cognizant of doing it, like some of the drawbacks for it. I would say, first and foremost, one of the biggest drawbacks is task loading because of the amount of equipment. Effectively, you've doubled the equipment that you're going to bring into the water with you. And so this creates a couple of issues. Number one, instead of one tank, you've got two. Instead of, you know, one regulator system, you're bringing in two. But it also changes hose routing and the amount of task loading that you're doing by switching between one regulator to another. That you're bringing in two SPGs that you're going to have to manage while you're on a dive. And you're also going to be in a position where you're managing the balance of tanks as you breathe from one and then the other, sort of to keep everything in place. So I would argue that is my number one drawback for, a novice person who wants to come into the world of side mount and start looking at it. Another thing that I would put out there for them, well, obviously, as goes along with the task loading, is the fact that there's a cost factor, right? So if you're going to double everything up, then, well, of course, it's going to cost you more money. So that's a definitive drawback from that. Another issue would be if you're doing a significant amount of shore diving, or if you have to travel a long distance from where you would necessarily park and or get ready to go into your dive site. Obviously, if you're going to carry tanks, then, you know, if they're placed onto your back like a backpack, it's going to be much easier to just throw those tanks on than it will be to, say, carry them strapped to the side of you or hanging on to them in your hands all the way down. So for me, when I look at it, there are definitely some drawbacks. I think some folks don't like the idea, I've spoken to as well, they don't like the idea of donning and doffing tanks while in the water. So they actually want everything on at the on shore, which I think is problematic in side mount. Because if you have your tanks on and you're going to, you know, you're basically going to put things on, it's easier for you to do that in water. Well, of course, if you have a rough entry or the, you know, it's very, you're very much in an area with a lot of waves and or surge coming through, that becomes problematic. So that's another piece that you have to take into account. And then, of course, the last one that I just chat about for tonight would just be boat entries. You do have to give some thought to how you're doing boat entries. Like, while you are able to do just about every entry that is done in back mount, you do need to be well aware and have practiced how those entries work. So, you know, something as simple as a back roll, making sure you know how to protect your tanks and have them clipped off properly so that you're not snapping bungees or having a tank come up and punch you in the face. These things are important. And so it does add an extra layer to your diving. But I think if you are willing to put a bit of time and effort into that, you get into what I would call all the benefits of side mount. And I think those, to me, far outweigh any of the drawbacks that I've come across. You know, in particular, the number one reason why I moved to side mount was because of, well, my two favorite things to talk about when I teach a class, buoyancy and trim, are almost intuitive. When you throw your side mount gear on, it forces you into proper buoyancy and proper trim if your equipment is set up correctly. Stability in the water is another thing, because really you have these two tanks that are acting as giant pontoons on the side of you, and you're incredibly stable as well. It brings your center of gravity into the center of your body, which means that your maneuverability is significantly better. And then streamlining. So overall, you become significantly more streamlined in the water. And this can reduce your work in the water and the amount of effort that you have to be able to move through the water column. So, I mean, I could continue going on with some of these, but I'm going to leave them there for now for consideration and open it up if there's any comments. And in particular, Neil, if you had a thought on the idea of side mount as being a benefit or a drawback in diving and what your thoughts might be there.
Well, I certainly have strong opinions.
Okay, fair enough.
And for me, all of the different modalities we have require a purpose. And if you have the purpose, I think side mount is fine. If you don't have the need for all that equipment, I think there are alternate pathways that can be better. For instance, getting in and out of a boat in side mount is not an easy thing. And so there are lots of downsides. For me, if you have a reason that side mount makes sense, like you're going to be doing some caves where the passageway is favorite, I think it can be good. But for a standard open water configuration, I'm not really a fan.
Yeah, it just harkens back to my side mount instructor, Dion, who would always say, you never know when you'll be swimming along and you end up in a cave.
Well, yeah, okay.
Dion is a character. So yeah, you know, he was always training, always training. Even the most relaxed fun dive is a training dive. So thanks, Mitt, for sharing those. I know it's tough digging in deep for those possible drawbacks of side mount, but I do appreciate it. Yeah. I also really appreciate you, Neil, joining us tonight. And thanks for sitting through this whole thing with us and taking part. It's really a lot of fun and super interesting.
It's been a pleasure for me.
And Nick, thanks for being here tonight.
It's a pleasure as always. Neil, thank you for being here. It was great chatting with you and very interesting stuff. So look forward to listening to the episode when it comes out next week.
April, thanks for being here tonight.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And again, Neil, it was great speaking with you and really, really interesting to hear what you had to say.
Well, thanks to all of you.
And Mitt.
And well, and I'll definitely say thanks again, Neil, just as a final ender there. And I really do hope I can somehow nail you down to get you back on here at some point. Not that I'm pushing that very hard at all, as you can tell, right? But, you know, as a fellow Canadian to another Canadian, you might have to come back on to, I think, what might be our only Canadian podcast on diving. So maybe we can bridge that gap and get you back on. But thank you very much for chatting with us tonight.
It won't take any effort to get me to come back because clearly I enjoy talking about these things and I'm never too shy with my opinion. So again, the platform is important.
We love a good opinion on Dive in the Podcast.
Talking about communication, if there's anything that listeners can like look up in your work to read or any of your communication, where might they be able to find some of that?
When I moved back to Canada, I grudgingly joined social media because I wanted people to be able to find me once I left the U.S. And so I do have a Facebook page that doesn't have personal things, but it does list, for instance, I'll probably, if I have some kind of link, I'd put something about this podcast on there. So I'm a minimalist in terms of entry, but it will often refer to new articles that come out or projects that are coming up. And so that can be found under my name. And my name, if you run it through Google, you can also come up with a number of talks that have been recorded that are freely available.
We'll make sure your Facebook link and related stuff is available in our show notes as well. You can follow the show on Instagram and Facebook with @divein.thepodcast. Our email is divein.thepodcast@gmail.com. You can also visit our website, www.divein.pod.com. On there, you can find links to our past episodes, host files, and so much more. On social media, you can follow me at iDiveOK. April is at April Weichert. Nick Winkler is at Nicholas Winkler Photography. You can find links for everything we mentioned on today's episode in the show notes or on our website, divein.pod.com. Next week, we speak to technical diving instructor and renowned underwater photographer, Audrey Cadell. This episode of Dive in the Podcast was brought to you by our sponsor, Torpedo Ray Scuba. Head on over to your favorite podcast app to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. It's very much appreciated. Thanks for listening.